Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The Biden administration recently submitted its first and much delayed and much anticipated 2022 defense budget request to Congress, asking for $715 billion to reshape U.S. forces to better deter China and Russia. Broadly, the measure prioritized research and development, as well as classified and nuclear modernization programs, improving pay and benefits, investing in infrastructure, and paring back acquisition efforts and retiring aging systems. Of that amount, the administration is asking for $173 billion for the United States Army in 2022, $3.6 billion less than in 2021. The service moved to cut research, development, testing, and evaluation, as well as acquisition spending by about $4 billion. Core modernization efforts remain on track, but among the 37 programs that were delayed or scaled back include the M1 tank, the armored multipurpose vehicle, the joint light tactical vehicle munitions, as well as communications equipment. Three programs were canceled, including the multifunction electronic warfare system, the Hellfire missile launcher, and the Spider network munitions system. Here to discuss the Army's budget, as well as its $5.5 billion unfunded requirements list, are Dr. Stacy Pettyjohn, the director of the Defense Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Andrew Hunter of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who served in the Pentagon as the director of the Joint Rapid Acquisition Cell. Andrew and Stacy, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago. It's a pleasure to be here.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. Stacy, there were expectations that the Army might consider dialing back people to underwrite modernization, to take a little bit more risk. You know, we've seen that the Marine Corps and certainly the United States Air Force have looked at this, right? C.Q. Brown, the Air Force chief, has said, it is much better for me to take some risk now because doing so now means less risk and cost later. Talk to us a little bit about what you made of this budget, what stood out, and maybe what the service got right and maybe what it didn't get right.
Sure. Thanks, Vago. I think the Army dodged a bullet in FY22. I was expecting there to be potentially larger cuts given what General Milley had warned about there being a bloodletting coming and suggesting that the Army was going to be the bill payer for the conventional modernization that's needed to effectively compete with China. It appears to me that the Army is hedging in this budget and that they are hedging against a future in which the department's priorities change, and they once again are going to be called upon to undertake counterterrorism or counterinsurgency operations, and they need a lot of BCTs to send to those fights. So they have protected their end strength, which is somewhat problematic in terms of the personnel account is one of the is growing at a faster rate than anything else and growing faster than inflation. So given the costs that are expanding in there and protecting their end strength, they're going to have less money down the road to invest in the future and to modernize the force.
Andrew?
Yeah, I think Stacey's very right about the hedging strategy. I liken it to the thing that's overwhelming all of us who are in Washington, D.C. right now, which is the emergence of the cicadas. And so we're kind of all waiting for the Army to undergo this transformation and translate its modernization priorities into a new and more capable force. And so some of the work, some of the chrysalis related work of that appears to still be going on and has been protected. But the Army has not yet burst out of the shell that is the old Army to flourish into the new Army that we're kind of waiting for. So it looks like that still can happen. I think it's obviously never a foregone conclusion with the Army that they will, that they'll achieve that, that we'll actually see this transformation happen because it hasn't always happened in the past. But as you pointed out, Vago, the top modernization priorities that the Army's identified, which I would say most observers have agreed are the right priorities to focus on, and that the Army has done good work at developing some prototypes and some intriguing capabilities for the future. But what we don't see yet is the shift into actually, we're going to shut down the production lines for the old and bring in production lines for the new. And, you know, that's probably not unexpected in the first year of a new administration with kind of a holdover budget from the previous administration that you'd see some deferral of those choices, especially as Stacy indicated, when you have a budget that was not one that the prior administration was really focused on Army first and foremost. They were as was widely reported, focused much more on naval force structure. And so, again, the Army was kind of flying under the radar for the most of the formulation of this budget.
And at the time, Chairman Milley made the statement he did, and the expectations were that the Trump administration, late in its tenure, was talking about a dramatic increase to the Navy, which, except for folks in the Navy, recognized that likely was not going to be maybe as robust as everybody thought. And as we heard from Brian McGrath and our very own contributing editor, Chris Cavas, that, you know, there was disappointment in naval circles that there is not as much money for ships, and that there has been, you know, will have to be reductions in not just a retirement of ships. And we've seen the same sort of thing from the Air Force in terms of, you know, proposing 221 aircraft that they're retiring. Stacy, doesn't this make the challenge? I mean, I understand that the Army is hedging and that this administration has given it a reprieve, right? I mean, it burns the biscuit of some in the Air Force that actually it's from, you know, in the terms of what the services budget is, it's actually smaller than the Army's budget, or as small as the Army's budget, considering the money has to go to the Space Force and so much pass through goes through, you know, that the Air Force doesn't control, but comes out of the Air Force top line. Is this a mistake? And doesn't this just make things harder for the Army and actually for the administration next year in terms of selling major muscle movements, right? I mean, it's not that people don't realize that there is a need for change. It's just that some of the ideas are considered good and positive and necessary, whereas others are like, look, your plans are not as good as maybe they can be. Doesn't this make the challenge worse for the Army next year if there are going to have to be bigger lifts?
I do think it could make the problem worse for the Army next year. You know, there is something to be said for biting the bullet and just sort of taking your medicine and going through the transformation as quickly as you possibly can. You haven't seen, as Andrew said, the Army being willing to ruthlessly prioritize the capabilities that are most relevant for the Indo-Pacific, like the Marine Corps has done with its Force Design 2030 with General Berger. The Army has, you know, it has protected its top modernization priorities, including the long-range hypersonic weapon. It's going to be paying for 4 batteries of mid-range capability, which is the post-INF missile, either SM-6 or Tomahawk for the Pacific. There's future vertical lift, but it has a very long list of modernization priorities, more so than any of the other services. I think they have done a better job, at least the Marine Corps and the Air Force, in terms of identifying the things that are most essential to them and most essential to the Pacific and some of the areas that they are willing to accept more risk and to divest of some capabilities and in some cases some missions.
Andrew?
Yeah, I do think there is a problematic aspect to this hedging strategy, and it is the challenge of when the directional shift comes. The groundwork maybe hasn't always been laid for it. You know, so for example, one of the striking things in this year's budget is the focus on divestment of, you know, legacy capability, and some of the services came out strong in this area. You know, the Army's section in the divestment is the Army divested $48 million of unnecessary capability in FY22. Other services are talking in the billions in terms of divestments that are savings as a result of divestments. You know, the Army makes a case, well, we, you know, they had the night court, they did their divesting previously, but that wasn't really divesting in the sense of retiring weapon systems. You know, it was more pruning back the modernization portfolio. So I think there is this there is this deferral. It goes back to the Army strategy with early in the Trump administration as the budget spigot turned back on and they had a sudden increase in funding. The way they used that was they went to go on current production lines and they ramped up production of systems that were already, you know, in production, many of which, you know, date back to the 1990s. Phenomenal systems in many cases, but not the sort of transformational systems that the Army's, you know, posturing for the future. And the challenge there is, you know, you build up employment, you know, in congressional districts. And so the production rate on that production line ties directly to jobs. And when you go to cut that production rate, you're going to cut those jobs. And so you're going to see pushback from Congress. There are a few notable areas where production rates were curtailed or slowed down in the Army budget. And that is in fact, so that they could make room for investing in things like Future Vertical Lift and in the new modernization portfolios. I think you're going to see some pushback on that. Some of it, the Army, I think, has entirely anticipated. I note that the Chinook Block 2 capability is on the unfunded list. I would put a lot of money on the idea that Congress will add funds for that because they have in the past. And so that's one area where they disinvested in the budget, but I think they're anticipating Congress is going to reverse that when it takes its shot at the budget. Well, Vago, one of the big changes in the Army budget is the change of OCO going away and all those funds being folded into the base budget. And the Army was the most impacted by that shift among the services. And it did see that funding, most of it be retained, but there were some reductions in the Army's O&M budget and in their modernization budgets related to the drawdown of forces overseas. And that, I think, obscured some of the good news in the Army's budget in terms of what has historically been its base budget. So I think there's some deferred pain. I think that will cause the Army issues. I think Congress will be reluctant to let go of some of these things. And then when the Army really does have to decide to divest, you know, I guess the question will it be able to travel down a road that the other services have cleared for it? Or will it find that, you know, Congress has essentially shuts the door on major divestments, lets a few through for the more aggressive services, and then kind of shuts down the rest of it. So it's a gamble for sure.
Let me ask whether this discussion that is ongoing in Washington, and I know you guys are participating in it as well, about what the vision of future warfare is. And there is a sense that the Marines and the Air Force really do have a vision and a recognition that which they have now is not suited for the things they have to do in the future. And there is this concern that neither, you know, I was talking to a good friend of mine who's naval strategist, and said it's not that the Navy's plans are classified. It's that the Navy says that its plans are classified in part because they're not very good. Is the concern that view of the future is not that clear, and so there's this disposition to cling to the present in terms of existing capability. And there is a little bit of a concern that's the case for the Army, that the Army created a portfolio of capabilities that would have been as true for George Washington, right? If he had looked at the Army, right? Give me way, you know, give me the vehicle, the weapon, obviously air defense being important, long range fires being important. I'm not minimizing it. Does the Army leadership have an integrated vision as to what potential conflict will look like in a great power scenario that is guiding its actions, right? I mean, is it clear that there is that vision of what the future looks like in a increasingly autonomous, increasingly big data, increasingly artificial intelligence future? And is it making the right case for change right before it might unveil a plan and need to sell it, if that makes sense, whichever one of you wants to start with that.
I'm happy to jump in. I think the Army actually does have a vision for the future with its multi-domain operations, what was formerly known as multi-domain battle. And they've been articulating it and trying to flesh it out over the last several years. The problem is that their vision or their preferred vision of the future is not against the priority adversary right now. The Indo-Pacific theater being a maritime theater, it really doesn't lend itself to the types of capabilities that are the Army's bread and butter and its real preference. And so a lot of MDO initially focused on Europe and being prepared to fight a great power war against Russia, and thinking it through in that context where ground combat is much more central to winning. And in the Pacific, in the Indo-Pacific, the Army has to transform itself into more of a long-range fires force and supporting force that provides all of the Title 10 sort of responsibilities that it has to support distributed air and maritime operations, which isn't something that is something that it, I think, would prefer to do. Planning for war in Europe is something that is more along the lines of what is accustomed to.
Wouldn't that argue, as some have, that Army takes primacy, for example, in Europe, right, where it's better suited for its existing capability and, right, that is much more of a terrestrial operational theater, and then have it have a slightly different role? I mean, as you said, sort of a supporting role in a Pacific theater, because I know that the Army sees itself as the central force in every conflict. We've had Admiral Mike Mullen join us, and you know, that's a, you know, case he made, right? I mean, the Army is central. Is that maybe an easier way of looking at this in terms of mission delineation, or is that something that's antithetical to the way the Army sort of sees itself and the role that it's likely to play?
It is. I just think that they fear that Russia is less of a priority for the Biden administration, and that it will become a declining priority going forward, as it's the revanchist power, not the pacing threat that China is. So it is reluctant to hang its hat only on that conflict, given that everyone else is focusing on China. Whether it makes sense to have the entire force and all of the surfaces really focus on that threat or not.
I would say it's illustrative of agree with that, first of all. But I want to say it's also illustrative of what our ambitions are vis-a-vis competition with China, because there's nothing that says you can't fight a land war with China if you choose to do so. You know, I think Bob Gates had a very sharp quote about the insanity of proposing to do such a thing. And so I think what we see is that even as, you know, China is identified as possibly, you know, the pacing threat for the U.S. military, you know, we're not contemplating building an army to go fight a land war against China. So it speaks to strategic choices that are being made about what competition with China is going to look like, how it's going to play out, that it's going to be done, you know, primarily in the maritime and in the air domains, because there is not a concept that we would consider in a land war a march to Beijing, for which you would need a very substantial, you know, land force to undertake such a campaign. So I think part of this is about, you know, the overall picture of what is it that we are contemplating the U.S. military having to do. And in that sense, you know, depending on one's perspective, you could see that as a sign of progress, because, you know, we really struggled and we've really struggled in the post-Cold War era to define missions for the military that seem to actually match up with things that the American public are actually interested in doing. And seizing Beijing is probably not among the list of things that the American public is ready to sign up for. So I do think that, you know, I just want to point out that I think there's an element of this to, there's a lot of choice involved, and choice even among Army leaders, that they aren't pushing for aggressive land operations in the Asian theater for the most part. But, you know, I think, again, there is a lot of hedging in the Army's approach, so they are not ruling out that possibility. And I know it's older rhetoric, but there's a lot of rhetoric in the Army's budget about regionally aligned forces, which to me kind of signals their, you know, oar in the water that says, you know, there are parts of the world other than the Indo-Pacific that we have to worry about. And the Army's really good in some of those other locations, and really important in some of those other locations. So they're making their case that we can't make it all about the Indo-Pacific. Certainly it's true that we find ourselves engaged and enmeshed in conflicts in other parts of the world that are not areas that we would like to be our strategic focus. And so there's certainly an amount of hedging there that's very appropriate.
you know, you may not be interested in war, but war may be interested in you. Although I will point out that former Secretary Gates's comments were controversial, and Mike Mullen had to call a lot of allies and partners across the Asia Pacific to reassure them that the United States would be there for them at the end of the day. Although for savvy observers, I think in part of frustration Secretary Gates had was the Future Combat Systems, the Army's flagship program for a number of years, was actually aimed at taking war to mainland China, if you will, which some people viewed as either visionary or highly problematic. Let me take you guys to the notion that the Army is developing a lot of cutting edge capabilities. It's working closely on JADC2, where there is an agreement between the Army and the Air Force. We heard from John Turpak and Todd Harrison, your colleague, Andrew, that the planned spending of it is not as robust, but it does look like the services are working some of those operational and connectivity issues. The Navy obviously developing its own systems that it is going to be synchronizing in order to try to get to this all domain system. But we find that there are actually some very big roles and missions issues that get raised when every part of the force has either hypersonics or long range weapons of a class that get into sort of what was a classical Air Force mission, which is the deep battle and the deep strike. We have air defense issues that get raised in part, how do you get the United States Army to field a Navy system that would defend the Air Force ashore? The Air Force asking, well, do I develop my own air defenses at this point? What are some of the roles and missions discussions that we need to have? I mean, is it time to have another Key West conference that looks at some fundamental elements of the force, especially when the threat is going to drive us to different solutions? Stacey?
I'm not sure it's time for another Key West and that a formal review would be that helpful, because historically they haven't resulted in significant changes. There is a lot of overlap that you pointed out, especially in long-range fires, air defense. But in some ways, having competition among the services can be healthy and good if it can be harnessed to generate the best ideas and the best capabilities. And at times, you are going to want redundant capabilities and systems because you're fighting a really capable adversary, or you're planning to fight a capable adversary. And efficiency isn't something that can be a priority in those type of conflicts. All of that being said, I do think there are some looming challenges that have emerged in the pages of the paper at times, and that the services need to do a better job articulating the different operational concepts that they're developing and how they plan to use these capabilities together to achieve core missions that would be necessary if we were to engage in a conflict. And that could actually be part of the competition and something that would be really healthy and good in terms of developing new innovative operational concepts.
Andrew?
I do think it's going to be increasingly challenging to try and police these lines between the services. We're also a little bit divided internally or inconsistent in our approach to it. So for example, thinking of space and cyber as emerging keys in the operational picture in a way that, much more important, significant, potentially decisive compared to, 20 years ago. In the case of cyber, we're still distributing that mission area across all of the services. And there's no reason why you pick any particular target anywhere on the earth, and you could say, well, that might be a Marine Corps cyber team, an Army cyber team, a Navy cyber team, an Air Force cyber team that might be, involved in some kind of operational way in dealing with that target. It's not clear that there would be a service-based answer to the question of who should take that mission on. With space, there's been a decision made to create the Space Force, and so we've aligned a domain and a service together. And all kinds of messiness to come. One of the things that I think to me didn't, I know they're wrestling with what parts of the Army might actually join the Space Force in the coming years. I didn't see much discussion of that in the budget, but it will have clear budget implications as it did for the Air Force. So I think you know, we're bifurcated in the way that we're thinking about trying to draw lines within the department. And in some cases, we're trying to align around domains. In other cases, we're looking at cross-domain. And I would say my own personal view is cross-domain makes a lot more sense to me. I think there's just the lines are too blurry and they're too artificial to draw in a really careful way. So I guess I would come down on the side, actually answering your question, Vago, that I don't think that we have the answers for a Key West type meeting to really be fruitful. And I will confess and plead my prior error in this case. You referenced Admiral Mullen, you know, when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs and I was on the House Armed Services Committee staff, we actually required a roles and missions review. And he pleaded with Chairman Skelton not to do that because he said it's going to be a giant waste of time. And he was right. And we did it and we put it in law and the services essentially just took a pass and it didn't really generate any positive outcome.
Let me last questions. One is on the unfunded requirements, right? $5.5 billion. Army was, I think, first out of the gate in sort of arguing that case. Obviously, the Air Force has its list. The Navy has its list in terms of the heartburn. How much redress do you both see, right? I mean, is 715, it's always a starting point, and lawmakers have shown a willingness to actually increase this amount. Is this going to be something where the Army is actually going to get back whatever it is that it cut or get most of it back? And if so, what are the parts that it needs to get back, right? I mean, so if you were advising members of Congress, what would you tell them to buy back?
It's going to be a fascinating debate. Obviously, Republicans in Congress, Chairman Inhofe, most notable among them, are really laying the groundwork for an aggressive push to plus up the defense budget. I'm not sure that the Biden administration will necessarily fight hard against that. If they can achieve a little more of their agenda on the domestic side by giving a little on defense spending, I think that's a deal they would happily take. But they're clearly setting it up to try and make that be a deal that they would hold back some of the defense spending potentially that the Republicans would like to see as a potential trade-off. That may be a conspiracy theory on my part, but the debate seems to be shaping up at least to trend in that direction. And so I think there is some possibility that the final top line could be higher than what the Biden administration is proposing. And I think it's quite possible that the Army could benefit in that. You know, I think a lot of people have said they think the divestments that have been proposed in the other services are not going to be well received in Congress. It might be reversed. That could chew up all the extra money. So in that sense, you know, maybe the Army won't do as well in Congress if Congress is focusing on stopping those divestments. But if it's focused on, you know, making a transformation to turn forward, I do think the Army has some advantages in that debate. You know, we've talked about, you know, their vision and, you know, how much it might appeal to folks. One thing I would point to is they've done a lot in what I would characterize as innovation infrastructure. And by that, I mean things like Project Convergence, right? So actual experimentation, demonstrations of capability that take things, you know, and some of these networks and other things that are, you know, tied to, you know, developing emerging commercial capabilities in artificial intelligence and in communications and demonstrating their utility in military operations, at least in that experimental framework. And then a lot of the OTA work, you know, the Army continues to be the leader and OTAs, other transaction authority agreements, which is where some of the most interesting development work is happening in DoD. So I think the Army has a pretty strong innovation infrastructure that they could capitalize on potentially quickly if there's a push in that direction or if the push from Congress takes in that direction and isn't just we're going to forbid all the divestments and then throw it a little extra money to make it possible.
Stacey?
I agree largely with everything Andrew said. I'm not sure the Army has as much to be gained potentially in an increase because they haven't cut as much in this budget as the others. So the likely big systems where there are already vested interests in Congress in maintaining those production lines, you know, the Chinooks, but there aren't as many others because the Army's just not divesting of as many systems here. But I do also agree the Army is pushing hard in terms of trying to think about how to integrate new capabilities and to demonstrate them, and that they're one of the few examples with the IVAS goggles that has transitioned the Valley of Death and actually acquired a very new capability that just hasn't existed before at a scale and quite quickly. So if more money were to appear, I'm sure they would find many, many ways to use it. But I have to say, when you have unfunded priority lists that are 18 pages long, it doesn't, I don't see as much prioritization there as if with a more curated select list.
Curated. I love that. We have a very brief amount of time. I want to ask you guys a quick logistics question. The Navy is buying 5 used ships to improve the nation's sea lift capacity. If you talk to Mark Busby, retired Rear Admiral, former Maritime Administration that oversees the sea lift fleet, he will tell you, after 1 week of a great power war, the bulk of that fleet would have been damaged or sunk. Are we thinking as creatively as we need to be thinking in the 2 minutes that we have left about logistics and how on earth we support and sustain penny packet forces that may be distributed among all of these islands and archipelagos in the Pacific, each one of which will have hypersonic missile battery? I mean, if you just go with some of the adages about how many, the volume of supplies necessary to support forces in the field, whether they're air forces or ground forces, it's massive. Are we thinking through that part of this great power challenge from your guys' standpoint, right? I mean, it's great to be talking about the technology, but at the end of the day, you've got to get the beans and the bullets to the other side of the Pacific. And it doesn't abundantly seem clear to me how we would do that. And it's not like our adversary doesn't know how to count. Stacy, and then Andrew, if you can bring us home.
No, is the short answer. I don't think we are. I think there's a lot of focus on the, executing kill chains and destroying enemy systems and thinking about integrating sensors and shooters, but actually how we support the force that is operating in such a distributed fashion is a huge question and is potentially the long pole in the tent and something that deserves a lot more of attention. And also is an area where the Army potentially has a huge role to play, whether it's in supporting the Air Force's ACE distributed basing concepts, or the Marine Corps as they're doing their EABO and hopping from island to island. None of this will work if we can't figure out how to execute it. One of the most challenging things I've seen or that sticks out to me with respect to logistics is just that it's often a personnel bill too, at least with the Air Force, whose concepts I've looked at most closely. They simply don't have enough maintainers to break down squadrons into as small of units as sometimes they're thinking about. So a lot more attention and effort needs to be paid to figuring out the sustainment and support underpinnings of these different ideas.
Andrew?
I concur wholeheartedly that logistics has been a huge blind spot. It has been for a very long time. And I think it remains one. I would like to see us get better at it. I'm not wildly optimistic that we will get significantly better at it. Interestingly enough, I think it is a great actual opportunity for the Army. We talked about the challenge of the Army being a supporting force in a potential Indo-PACOM conflict. Personally, I see no shame in being a supporting force. And in fact, when you look through budgets, you'll often find supporting forces may get the most, can get a lot of money. There's a lot of money that goes into supporting forces. So it's not always the worst place to be. I think the Army has a ton to contribute. And, my own suspicion is that a conflict in the Indo-Pacific could be one and where a very defensive kind of struggle, where emerging from highly defended positions is highly risky for all sides. In such a conflict. And so having highly defended positions that one can defend vigorously is going to become, I think, really critical. And that's something the Army is actually pretty good at. I think the problem is culturally within the Army, the parts of the Army that do that mission are always the ones that do the worst in their prioritization scheme. We talked about air and missile defense being one of the areas that's down. One of the only CFTs within the Army that saw its modernization budget go down versus some of the other parts of the Army modernization strategy. So, you know, I think it's going to be incredibly hard for the Army to see a future for itself in which this defense and support function may be the primary or the most important function, and to allocate its resources accordingly. But in that sense, if you want to be a wild optimist, a glass half full person, it's an opportunity for the Army to compete for budget share on that basis.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you guys back, especially to get an update as we go through the process here. Thanks so much again for joining us.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.